It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Scientists at the University of Pennsylvania are growing bits of brain matter in petri dishes. The cerebral organoids, as they're called, need very little manipulation. The brain cells are put together and allowed to develop and do, much like a fetus develops in the womb. This is groundbreaking science and could lead to a better understanding of our mostly obscure knowledge about how brains function. But is it also creating something that is conscious? And what are the ethical limits of creating a conscious thing and then conducting experiments on it? Insoo Yun is a professor of bioethics and philosophy at Case Western Reserve University of Medicine. He's the author of the book Bioethics and the Future of Stem Cell Research. He joins us today by phone. Insoo, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what exactly is this kind of research trying to accomplish?
Well, it's trying to accomplish a couple of things. One of the main things is to study how the brain develops and how different cell types arise. And so it's a great tool for developmental biologists who want to study an aspect of human biology you otherwise cannot observe in the laboratory. And secondly, once you have these tools, once you have these models of the human brain, both diseased and healthy, you can also do some medical tests on them, for example, drug screening tests or other experiments to know whether certain disease models could be improved or ameliorated through medical interventions before you go to human trials and before you go to animals, if at all, going to animals.
And how sophisticated are these brain bits?
So the field is moving rather quickly. It's only been a few years since it was discovered that stem cells have this incredible capacity to self-organize, with just very little instruction, self-organize into these developing clusters of brain tissue, which normally represent various regions of the brain. The science has gone rather rapidly to this point where now people are trying to recapitulate or grow all the different cell types of the human brain and to grow it for a very long time. So you mentioned in your lead-in that these brain models will go through fetal stages, and that's absolutely true, but if you can grow them for over a year or more, then they actually start to exhibit more adult cell-like properties and start to model more of the adult human brain.
Okay, so that's kind of frightening to me, Insoo. how adult-like do these brains get? Can they actually think? Are they actually sentient?
Right. So that's going to be an immediate area of curiosity for many people other than the scientists, and for scientists themselves. So the key issue is, the limitation is, getting these brain models to grow in the lab for a long period of time because they do mature slowly, just like a real human brain. And so the key challenge is to make sure that they get enough nutrients, that there's circulation. And so because there are no blood vessels in these models, it is quite a challenge to maintain them for a very long time. But you raise a good question. I mean, what if we start to get to the stage of human brain development or some region of the human brain where consciousness is possible or sensation or experience? And philosophically, one wonders, how would you even know if that's happening?
Right.
If there are these experiences. You can't ask the brain organoid, hey, so how are you feeling today? And obviously there's no way to respond. So there's no input or output to this model, right? It's just a cluster of really fascinatingly working, interlocking cells and tissue. The thing about consciousness you have to remember is that it involves the entire human brain. It involves the entire human brain after quite a bit of development, so not in the very, very early fetal stages, obviously. And it involves signaling across major regions. So if you don't have yet all the regions of the brain model and all the cell types, then biologically, you just don't have the basis for consciousness, so we believe. But philosophically, there's always a question of, well, how would one actually know? And that's always been a challenge. Even in philosophy, how would you even know that a comatose patient doesn't have any experience?
That's a good question. Also, I want to go back to the brains themselves. Do they come from donors? Where are we getting these bits of brain matter?
Right, that's a great question. So they come from cell donors. So what you can do now is you can get any patient or any healthy volunteer, take any cell from their body, let's say their blood cells, gut cells, skin cells, any cell that's easy to get, and you can reprogram these body cells into stem cells that can become any kind of cell. So that's the first step. The first big breakthrough is making your normal cells, turning them into stem cells. And then once you get the stem cells, you can direct them to different kinds of cell lineages in the human body. And what people have learned is as you start nudging them toward the brain-type cell development, and you put them together, they'll actually self-organize and talk to one another to then go through all the stages of human development early on. So the brain models can come from patient cell samples or healthy volunteers, and you actually want to compare the healthy brain organoids with the disease, so to speak, disease brain organoids. So they come from patients, they come from people who volunteer to provide their cells for this kind of research.
We are talking to bioethicist Insoo Hyun. He's exploring the ethical questions of growing brains in laboratories. I want to get to this idea of consciousness that we're talking about, and also the idea of scientists questioning their own work in this way. That's not something that I have seen in my life. I've seen scientists doing their science and ethicists going, whoa, 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 what are you doing? Where is this coming together?
That's a great question. So what I'm experiencing, what the field of bioethics and science is experiencing now is the removal of these silos where there's a division of labor. The scientists are in their science silos, and the bioethicists like me are in our ethics silos and social, you know, concern silos. What the researchers now know, and I think a lot of this stems from the past couple of decades of the human stem cell experience where it got so political and it got so heated, that many of those leading researchers in the stem cell field have now moved on to this brain organoid field. And I think they bring that experience with them, that we need to engage ethics and policy, and we need to engage sort of the larger social questions that our research raises. So now we're luckily, happily, in a space where there's great openness among scientists, and they realize there's kind of an artificial distinction or divide between this idea of science is one thing, ethics is the other. They realize the science that they're doing, and if they want to do it well, has to involve ethical consideration. So now there's a lot of talk between ethicists like me and the scientists as they're trying to better their brain models. The really fascinating thing is it's going to go far beyond simply growing a brain model in addition to studying it. It's going to now get into the field of putting these things together with bioengineered devices. So you get these weird combos of biology and human development with bioengineering, and then you end up with an entity that actually does not exist on Earth right now. There's nothing like a little brain organoid that's paired with some sort of biological device that will read, signals from the brain. There's nothing like that that you find in nature. So the researchers realize these are highly unusual, novel entities. They don't even really know what to call some of these things, and they need the help of people like me to think through some of the issues before you do an experiment that eventually you realize many people are very, very upset about.
Okay, so I want to talk about the public backlash here, because what you just described could become the Borg. It could be something that takes over the world, and people like me are afraid of that. So how do you reassure us that this isn't going to be some sort of science fiction gone off the rails?
Yeah, sometimes I hear about these ideas that the researchers want to do as the next step, and I kind of wonder out loud, isn't this how Terminator started?
Yes.
Mixture of machine and brain, neural tissue. So how do we deal with this? So like I said, the researchers are trying very hard to be more proactive and involve a discussion along the way. But I think a couple of things the public needs to keep in mind. One is, you have to have public support to fund a lot of this research. And so obviously the public has to be on board. But it's not, you have to realize, scientists are not simply doing things just because they're randomly curious. They just want to see what happens.
Okay, Insoo, I'm going to have to stop you there. We're running out of time. Insoo Hyun is a professor of bioethics and philosophy at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. He's been talking to us about the bioethics of stem cell research. Thank you for joining us, sir. It's the morning show On the Ideas Network, I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our leaders must speak candidly and apolitically about threats to our election systems. So says a report compiled by dozens of legal experts, computer scientists, and election officials about the security of elections in the U.S. Kevin Kennedy was one of the people who served on the committee. Actually, it was about three committees that researched our election security and published the report, Securing the Vote, Protecting American Democracy. He is the former director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Megan Wolf also joins us. She is the interim administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan, thank you for being here. I bet you're pretty busy these days.
I am, but thank you so much for having me.
So, Kevin, let's start with you. The committee for this report, and I said three committees because I read the report, and there was like, this committee comprises these people and these chairmen, and then this committee comprises these people and these chairmen, but you put up the number one. So I'm saying I think you're disagreeing with me.
Well, the second two committees are permanent committees that sort of oversee all the work and would have reviewed our report. But the 14 people that served on the committee that you first described was the working committee.
So what is the goal of this report? How did it start out in 2016 and how did it change?
Well, the Carnegie Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation approached the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine and wanted to fund a look at the future of voting. They wanted an assessment of where voting was, looking at technology, and looking for recommendations for easier, accessible, reliable, and verifiable elections. And that was really the initial goal of the committee. But obviously, there were a lot of things that happened in 2016 that brought some other attention to it. So security became a very big focus of the committee.
And what did the 2016... security in terms of the 2016 election, I hear two tales told. One is hacking into social media accounts and influencing people. And then I hear hacking into or trying to hack into actual election systems. What did you find?
We found that both were really a factor. We focused on the hacking or the attempts to hack into or the vulnerabilities of the infrastructure of the election system. There was discussion about the social media and the political influence, but that we sort of left behind since the charge of the committee was on the future of voting. We really looked at the vulnerabilities that we have with our election administration infrastructure.
So the report makes suggestions to harden our infrastructure. What are the challenges here and how do we need to harden them?
Well, it's interesting because, the main recommendations were the use of paper ballots and not using the internet for voting. But there are actually 40 recommendations covering a whole range of matters. But the idea was, one, we need to harden the infrastructure, use primarily paper ballots for conducting all elections, recognizing it may be a little late for 2018, but definitely by 2020. Post-election auditing, particularly using more risk-limiting audits because they're much more efficient.
Meaning what?
Well, post-election risk-limiting audits are audits where you use a statistical sample to determine how reliable are the election results. It helps you identify whether there's any differences in what the outcome says and what would be predicted to be based on those audits.
So what you're saying is use paper ballots in some form or another, not just I'm writing this with a pen, but also I'm doing this through the computer and it's printing a paper ballot. That's okay too?
That's correct.
Okay. And after you use the paper ballot, we should all states should go back and do audits to make sure that the voting is correct.
That's also correct.
So we are talking with, you just heard Kevin Kennedy. He used to be on the Government Accountability Board, and he is part of a committee that put together some recommendations for security for our elections. We're going to ask you to call in. What do you think about election security? What ideas do you have to make it better? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet and mention at WPR Mornings. We are going to bring in Wisconsin Elections Commissioner, interim administrator, Megan Wolf, right now. We'll talk later about what's being done in Wisconsin specifically, but when you look broadly at what election officials face every day, what is your take on these challenges and this report?
Well, I think that this report is a really good demonstration of how election officials across this country have really come together to try to formulate best practices and to learn from one another and really secure elections on a national scale. Here in Wisconsin, we've made a lot of changes and addressed a lot of the concerns that are outlined in the report, but we've done so with a lot of our federal partners, really utilizing the services that are available through some of our national election partners, like Homeland Security, as well as, again, learning from some other states in their best practices.
And we got a lot of money from the federal government, correct?
We did get some money from the federal government. So Help America Vote Act, there was some funding made available for election security. Wisconsin received about $7 million in grant funds.
That's a decent amount. And what have we done with it?
Well, we have a two-phase approach to spending those funds. The first is implementing some security measures technologically. And the second is to solicit feedback from our local election officials and the public on the best ways to continue to spend those funds. Election security is very dynamic. Mm. We need to have funds available to continue to address concerns that will come our way down the pipe. It's not something that's going to be done and have kind of a finite end.
Right. People are always looking for new ways to hack. I talked with Kevin a moment ago about two of the main recommendations that people are talking about is that you have paper ballots, and that you have you do a post-election audit. Wisconsin has paper ballots, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Here in the state of Wisconsin, there's two types of voting equipment, optical scans and DRE. So about 85% of our ballots cast are used paper ballot, where you actually feed that paper ballot through a tabulator. And the others are cast on a touch screen where a sort of a receipt or a printout of how you voted and you're able to verify is printed along with those selections.
Do we have automatic audits after the elections?
There are audits before the election, and then after a general election, no fewer than 100 randomly selected municipalities are audited. We are making some recommendations to our commission to potentially expand some of those audit practices throughout the state.
We are talking about a new report on election integrity that calls for states to use paper ballots and increase worker training and also audit the ballots. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Do you think that we need to be more secure? Have you noticed things when you're voting that you have questions about? 800-642-1234. Kevin, this report includes recommendations, as you said, on a variety of things, but the response, one of the things that we have talked about before is sort of like the connective tissue between, okay, I made my vote, and then the person collecting the votes is going to call them in or send them in. And in that sending them in, those votes could be lost. They could be hacked. Did you guys look at that kind of thing?
Yes, we definitely looked at that. And most of the results that you get on election night are not official results. There's a intense canvassing process that goes on in the 2 weeks following the election that really detail and verify looking at the paper records. But looking at the vulnerabilities of election night is important. And even in Wisconsin, that was an issue back as far as 2011, where there were people who were not taking that as seriously as they should have and not double-checking the numbers before they were getting posted.
Megan, when you look at your system, what are the vulnerabilities that you see?
Well, there are a lot of different facets to election administration, but I think that here in Wisconsin, one of the things that we have going for us that can be a challenge but also a strength is our decentralized election administration here in the state of Wisconsin. Most other states administer elections at the county level, so they may have 50 to 100 election officials locally. Here in Wisconsin, we have 1,853
yes.
municipal
and
clerks.
And why does that, like, convince me that shouldn't scare me? That's a good thing you're saying.
Well, you know, each of those clerks really has a very local connection with the people that they serve. If something is unusual in their voter rolls, if something is unusual with their voter activity, they're going to notice that because they have that personal and local connection.
When you came together to look at why this happened, did the report say anything about when we were looking at hacking in specifically? Did the report say anything about whether or not Russians were successfully able to hack anything?
Well, we didn't look at any confidential information or top secret information. Everything that we looked at was publicly available, but we had over 50 different people making presentations to us, including former head of the CIA, General Michael Hayden. And it was very clear from the reports that we had that are in the public domain that, yes, Russians were knocking at the door, were attempting to infiltrate infrastructure, and there were at least two cases outside of Wisconsin where they were successful in getting in.
So when this thing started, when this committee started, you were looking at whether or not we could vote electronically. Are you still looking at whether or not we could vote electronically, or is that totally off the table?
Well, by electronically, if you
like,
mean...
Like, you know, from my home, from my computer, secure internet.
One of the conclusions we came to was that we are not at that point where we're going to have secure internet voting. In fact, even transmitting a voted ballot electronically is something that the committee recommends strongly against.
We are going to keep talking right now to Megan Wolf and Kevin Kennedy about our election security. We will be back in a moment. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Securing the Vote, Protecting American Democracy. It's a new report put out by a bunch of academics, legal experts, computer scientists, and state and local election folks about the state of our voting systems. The report recommends that every state have a paper ballot record by 2018. It also recommends that the federal government should invest more money in poll workers to ensure the integrity of the system. Do you trust the election systems in your county or state? Does it worry you that security experts revealed that Wisconsin's election data was the victim of attempted hacking by Russians in 2016? Or does it make you feel good that the attack didn't work? We're taking your calls this morning. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is where you can email your questions, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking this morning to Kevin Kennedy. He's the former director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board. And Megan Wolf is the interim administrator of the Wisconsin Election Commission. Megan, I want to start with you right now. 2018, that was kind of surprising when I read that in the report. Is it possible for any state to make changes in the next month and a half?
Well, I don't know that we can make significant changes. We can increase the vigilance and the diligence that we are already exercising towards securing elections. So creating that culture of security within our organization, continuing to train our local election officials, and make them aware of some simple things that they can do to make sure that they're operating in a secure way.
Okay. So knowing your people, as you mm-hmm. pointed out, that's an important thing. But what are some of the other things they can do?
Some of the other things that we are looking to do is also implementing things like multi-factor authentication in our statewide voter registration system. Mm. So these are things that you can do to help protect who has access to the system. We're also able to create some additional protections and layers within our system to make sure that we're segregating information and that we have other sets of eyes and automated processes to make sure that we're flagging any irregularities and that we're able to restore correct information should there be any type of incidents.
And when this voter information comes in, Kevin, it's put into poll books? And those poll books are, do we have electronic poll books here, Megan?
We actually just launched an electronic poll book that we built here in the Wisconsin Elections Commission. We built it in-house, and 8 municipalities will be using that for the November election.
Okay, so when they are put into the poll books, which are, you know, lists of voter people who are registered to vote, right? How do we make sure that that is secure as they go out to the polling places?
Well, I think Megan covered it pretty well, but the voter registration database, which generates the poll books, whether they're on paper or electronic, is really the backbone of most election management systems. And that's why, people were talking about access to the vote totals, it's really important to make sure that you have protected the integrity of that voter registration system, because that's the gateway. That's how people know that they're eligible to vote. Even campaigns are using that information to go out and campaign. So it's a very key element, and I think Megan pointed out, and the committee certainly looked at that, it was one of its big recommendations was to constantly monitor the security of that voter registration system.
Megan, I can go up to the polls on November 7th, right?
And
6th. Thank you very much. On November 6th, and if I go on the 7th, then I don't get to vote. But and register to vote right there, right? As long as I have a Wisconsin ID and a place to live, I can register to vote at the polling place. So how do you kind of manage? You've got your poll books. But I haven't registered yet. How do you manage that?
So one of the big benefits with electronic poll books is you're able to see records from the statewide system. And so as we are able to grow that program, it also kind of grows the transparency and the information that you have available to you at the polls to do some checks. But that being said, you know, Election Day registration is really been a fail-safe for voters. If there were to be any kind of incident, it ensures that they're able to register to vote and cast a ballot. There are a lot of checks in place, and voters are attesting to a lot of very serious information when they register to vote. Someone is also sent a verification postcard after they register to vote on Election Day. And if that is returned or if there's information that is off, that information is investigated to make sure that the voter is legitimately registered.
So I want to go back to this 2018 recommendation from the report. There are some states, I think there are four of them, and Georgia is one of them, that doesn't have paper ballots. Are you hearing from those states, and did you talk to representatives of those states when you were putting the report together about whether they can make this change in the next couple months?
We did hear from those states, among the 53 different people who came to us, and it is a very big challenge. It's been an ongoing debate. There are 14 states that either in whole or in part are not using paper ballots. Georgia being one of them for the entire state, and they're actually involved in litigation. This report was actually cited in the litigation last week to push Georgia along. It is a difficult thing to implement something this late in the game, but it's part of the discussion. What this report really does is it puts some backing behind a lot of the concerns that have been raised over the past few years about the vulnerability of the system.
Litigation. Talk to me about that.
I'm not intimately familiar with all of the litigation that's involved, but I do know that the Georgia Secretary of State's office and the locals have been sued, trying to force them to abandon their touchscreen voting system, which was put in place in 2002 and has been the mainstay of how Georgia conducts its elections, but it has no paper record. And I know they were in court. I haven't seen any orders on that, but it is a difficult challenge to get that done, and the report recognizes that, saying, if not by 2018, let's have it done by 2020.
Okay, so you put out this report, and each state does their own election. This is a constitutional thing. How do you ensure, or how do you convince each state to have these kind of uniform standards?
Well, again, that's one of the diverse strengths of the American election system is its diversity, and it allows for various experimentation. One of the things we learned by talking to local election officials and other individuals was just how far ahead of the curve some states were. I mean, Wisconsin has been well positioned on election security since before 2016, so there was a lot to learn there. We looked at other states, and that's really one of the benefits. The report put together by the National Academies really has, a very thorough discussion, and the idea is to foster that discussion, support some of the changes that have been made. That was our charge, was to look at what recommendations can we make to ensure that it's easier to vote, it continues to be accessible to everyone, that it's reliable, and that it's verifiable. And those were the components that we focused on.
Gary from Iron River says that he doesn't have a record. So we're going to put him through right now. Gary, Welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning, folks. My question is, how do we ensure that someone isn't registered to vote twice in two states? An example would be a college student who's going to school here registers on the day of the vote, but is also registered in his home state and votes absentee.
So here in the state of Wisconsin, we actually compare data with other states. We're also part of the Electronic Registration Information Center, also known as ERIC. And that is where we receive and we also contribute reports of who's registered to vote in our state. And we ensure that our lists are maintained in accordance with that information. And so that's been a real benefit, is to make sure, again, that states are talking and that we share information so that we can make sure that we have the most accurate information across states.
Is this a widespread problem? Do people actually vote in two different states?
Well, if someone were to vote in two states, they would be subject to some very serious penalties, including felony charges. And so it's not something that we see often. If we did get information from another state that we had a voter that voted twice, one time in each state, that would be followed up on and would be prosecuted by the appropriate jurisdiction.
And as you're going through this report, did you look at that kind of thing, the voter fraud issues?
We definitely looked at that, and the cross data sharing was one of the recommendations, and the Electronic Registration Information Center was singled out in one of the recommendations, also encouraging them to ensure that their practices were as vigilant as what we were asking for with our state and local election officials. But it's an example of where we saw a number of states ahead of the curve.
So what are the states ahead of the curve? We are one of them, but what are the other ones that we're looking to?
Well, Colorado and Wisconsin, Minnesota, very strong in those states. And most states have something that you can point to where we look at and say, hey, we could gain some definite information. Best practices.
We are talking about the security of our elections on the morning show, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. What do you think about election security? Are you confident that your vote is going to count and that it's not going to be hacked? Give us your call, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be back in a moment talking about election security with Megan Wolf, who is the interim head of the interim administrator of Wisconsin Election Commissions, and also Kevin Kennedy, who sat on the committee for Securing Our Vote, Protecting American Democracy. We'll be back to talk more about election security and take your calls. It's the morning show. Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. A new report called Securing Our Elections calls for changes to some state election practices before the 2018 midterm, which is less than two months away. Our guests today say that may not be possible, but at least it's starting the conversation. What do you think about voting systems in Wisconsin and in other states that you've come from? How do they compare? Are there vulnerabilities that you see as a voter? 800-642-1234. for, ideas@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're sitting here with Kevin Kennedy. He is the former director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board here in Wisconsin. And Megan Wolf is the interim administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. There was something that did come out of this report, Kevin, called the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. There were a number of times where the report said Congress must authorize and fully fund. What will this do?
Well, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission was created by the Help America Vote Act in 2002, and it is a small federal agency which has two very important missions. One is to serve as a clearinghouse of information for state and local election officials for best practices. It does not have any rulemaking authority, but it does serve a very vital function in exchanging information, collecting information, making recommendations on best practices, fostering studies. It also runs a certification program for voting equipment. Right now, that's for tallying equipment and, you know, what counts your votes. And most states, including Wisconsin, require that all equipment be certified by the U.S. Election Assistance Commission in its partnership with the National Institute on Standards and Technology to meet certain standards before it can even be marketed in the state of Wisconsin.
And if we have this commission in place, is there some sort of connection that we can have some sort of overriding rules for all 50 states, or is that totally off the table?
Well, politically, that's a hard thing. Because the Constitution provides that the states are in charge of elections, you're going to see a lot of resistance to a federal agency setting certain standards. Obviously, we do have them with respect to equal access to voting in terms of equal rights and lack of discrimination and enforcing those areas. What the Election Assistance Commission, if it were fully staffed and fully funded, one of the problems is only half the commissioners have been in place. And that will lead to them not being able to take action, for example, on certifying voting equipment. But the idea that was recognized by the committee was everything is a partnership here. We have the structure in place with the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Let's make sure that it's fully operational. Let's empower it to do more studies, to have enough funding to reach out and continue its collaboration with state and local election officials.
When was this commission set up, and how long has it been not fully staffed?
It was created in 2002 by the Help America Vote Act. It got into place late 2003, I believe. And it has a history in that 15-year period of not having a full complement of election commissioners. Recently, one of the commissioners who spoke to us left to go to the Department of Homeland Security when the speaker announced he was not going to renominate him to serve on that commission. And so they're down to two. With three, they could operate, but they haven't even had all four commissioners in place for the past several years.
And this is under Democratic Congresses, Republican Congresses, Democratic presidents, Republican presidents.
That's right. Although the commissioners are presidential appointees, it's a bipartisan nomination. You know, the idea is to have two Republicans, two Democrats, with each House of Congress. The leadership making those nominations.
Megan, the report talks about infrastructure, and Kevin just talked about, you know, sort of having an overall watchdog for making sure that what vendors provide is secure. What are we doing here to make sure that our election infrastructure is secure?
Sure. So when we're talking about election infrastructure, I think there's two really important pieces. One is voting equipment, and the other is the statewide voter registration database. As far as voting equipment is concerned, as Kevin said, the Federal Election Assistance Commission, they do certify and create that base level of certification for voting equipment. We then put any voting equipment that is offered for sale here in the state of Wisconsin through a vigorous process of certification here in the state. And that protocol was developed with our system in mind, the needs of our clerks in mind, and additional security measures that we've deemed appropriate for our state. And so it goes through both of those protocols. The recommendation is then brought to our commission, who then reviews that and then ultimately allows for a piece of voting equipment to be utilized here in the state of Wisconsin.
Who do we use?
We use a variety of vendors. So there's actually the clerks do have the discretion to choose who they use once a piece of equipment has been certified. So there are a number of different voting vendors.
And we are, Kevin, I want to lift the veil on this a little bit. You took testimony from people. What went into creating this kind of report?
Well, again, we had public hearings, five public hearings, and we had several people, representatives from industry, the Election Assistance Commission, local election officials, security individuals. We invited all of the major voting equipment manufacturers. We did not get participation, quite frankly, from the two largest vendors of voting equipment. But, you know, we spent quite a bit of time looking at the marketplace, and there are recommendations to continue a collaboration among local election officials, political scientists, and the industry to really work to improve this accessibility. And there's a lot of recommendations to say when there is a problem with voting equipment, it should be reported to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, because too often what happens is where there is a problem, it's very localized and people don't know, and it could be something that's repeated in other parts of the country.
Megan, one of the things I want to ask you about is pre-programming of the election equipment. There are a lot of smaller counties that kind of outsource this pre-election programming. That is a vulnerability where something could possibly be hacked. What are we doing to ensure that that's not happening?
So the counties do have the option to contract with their voting equipment vendor to do some of the programming. That being said, that we're working with them, with the counties as well as at the national level, to see what we can do to continue to make those contracts that they have with the vendors more robust, to include security provisions and transparency provisions for those processes.
Kevin, you listened to a lot of testimony. You spent a great deal of time. What was the most surprising thing? Let's start with that. What was the most surprising thing you found out?
Well, as someone who'd worked in elections for over 30 years, there wasn't a lot that surprised me on one level. But, you know, a large number of the committee were academics, and it was really heartening to hear, you know, their detached evaluation of things. The two chairs were not from this area, the president of Indiana University and the president of Columbia University. And so they did a masterful job of guiding the committee, but by asking questions from people who did not have that experience. I think, as I said at the outset, we were prepared to be looking at where are we going with elections, and the focus really became how do we instill confidence through this constant challenge of security issues.
How do you instill confidence?
Well, I think the report tries to lay out a roadmap and point out this is a dynamic process. It's not something that's going to stay still. You can't rest on your laurels. That there's evolving threats and evolving changes, and really I think the recognition was that we need to devote the resources to support that collaboration among state, federal, and local officials, to involve academia, to involve the business of voting as well in this process.
This report was incredibly informative to me, but it was also a little existential. Like, there gave me some existential angst, and mostly it's summed up in this appendix thing that I read. As political scientist Francis Fukuyama noted in a report in the U.S. Department of State, the speed and scale of today's weaponization of information is unprecedented. The traditional answer to the spread of bad information has been to inject good information on the assumption that truth would rise to the top. But in a world of trolls and bots where simple facts are instantly countered by automated agents, this is not adequate. Do you have confidence that we're going to be able to rise above this this electronic attack, constant attacks that we are getting?
I have confidence because it's very clear that our election officials take this very seriously. I think this report does a lot to highlight that, and I understand you have it posted on your website, and yes, I would encourage people to look at that.
It is highly readable. We have been talking to Kevin Kennedy. He is the former director and general counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Megan Wolf is the interim administrator of the Wisconsin Election Commission. Thank you both for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.